Cory Doctorow is a best-selling author, co-editor of the website Boing Boing, activist in residence at MIT's Media Lab, and former European director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. His latest novel is Walk Away, which has received praise from sci-fi author William Gibson and NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden. Thanks so much for making time for KDNK Community Radio, Cory.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So talk about what got you started writing Walk Away and why you wanted to explore utopian ideas, not just standard dystopian sci-fi.
Yeah, I actually think of it as kind of a mix of the two. I call it an optimistic disaster novel. And, you know, the idea of optimism and disaster, it started when I read this book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell. She's a wonderful historian, a very sprightly writer who really makes her subjects come to life. And she wrote about how historically, we remember disasters as being times in which people really like revealed their inner beast, that there are times in which people riot or in which they turn on their neighbors. But that when you examine the actual records of these disasters, when you go to the gold standard, which is like first person contemporaneous written accounts, the things people wrote down while it was happening when they were there, what you find is that disasters are actually sometimes the most glorious times in people's lives. They experience them and remember them as this moment in which the kind of background refrigerator hum of petty grievance stops, and they realize what's genuinely important, which is their shared destiny with their neighbors, and all of the old fights die as they go to try and rebuild. But at the same time, there's this idea that the richer you are, the less likely you are to believe that. So probably the more you have to rely on people you pay to take care of you instead of a kind of mutual set of obligations get along. And that as a result, there's this thing called elite panic, where in times of crisis, oftentimes the rich and powerful will deploy soldiery and police and mercenaries to defend themselves against the hordes that they know must be coming. And that actually becomes the thing that turns the disaster into the catastrophe that stops people from being able to rescue themselves. And so, you know, that idea I thought was very powerful. And I wonder why it was that so many of our stories, really fun stories, stories I enjoy, always start with, you know, this kind of man versus nature versus man story where the earthquake knocks your building down and your neighbors come over to eat you. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought it must have something to do with the glorious tradition of pulp plotting, where when we write pulp stories, we try to make the plot the most important thing. I love writing and reading pulp fiction. And so you can ask the reader to suspend their disbelief about things that aren't probably true, and among them is this supposed human nature that causes people to turn on each other when the lights go out. You know, what I realized is that you could come up with an even more fascinating plot, provided that you made the story turn not on the bad guys being the ones who attack the good guys, but rather that we're all more or less good guys, but we all have flaws, and we don't necessarily agree on what should be done next, and that in times of a crisis, that you may end up not fighting the bad guys who come to eat you, but the good guys who, just like you, think that we should all be trying to help each other out, but have a foundational disagreement with you about what should be done.
Walk Away is set in a near future where money is controlled by elites and technology has left many people unnecessary, so more and more of them walk away from the system and build off-the-grid collectives. One of the themes of Walk Away is this idea that unhappy people do substandard work. Are there examples in the real world that influence this concept in the novel that systems should be built around mastery and cooperation instead of competition and credit?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, one of the things that the internet has given us is this kind of supercharged hobbies. Hobbies that start to kind of sit on the threshold between hobby and vocation that are really, they're like avocations. They're you know, this kind of medieval or Elizabethan idea that you have the thing that you do, but then you have the thing that you're passionate about. And what networks did is they let everyone who had some, you know, strange, not very densely experienced passion find the people scattered all over the world who are as passionate as them and build up these really passionate communities that pursued mastery and self-reinforcing communities and solidarity and support. So, you know, it's the difference between like being a subscriber to Popular Mechanics in 1940 and having a wood shop in your garage and being a maker in, 2017, and being able to go on the internet and find some other maker somewhere in the world who tried to solve a problem almost like yours, read their description of their solution, try your own solution, maybe going to a local makerspace, and then iterate until you find the solution to your variation of the problem and put that online so that the next person can also come along and do it. You know, that kind of mastery, and it's really what drove programming and software development, especially in its early years, that seems to be in the DNA of the 21st century. It's how all of the most exciting stuff seems to have gotten its start, which isn't to say that there aren't some people who get in it for the money, but there's this core of people who, for example, believe in the internet and who consider themselves stewards of it because they became technical people by using the internet to both discover and strengthen and perfect their technical interests.
The character in the story, Limpopo, says to some walkaway noobs, "It doesn't matter where you are or what's around you, if you can cover your basic needs and find something productive to do." Can you talk about why you wanted to show that the world doesn't have to be based on scarcity, that there's another way of seeing things, that we could live under conditions of abundance?
Sure. You know, I've been writing about this since my first novel. And in 2003, I published this novel called Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. Mm. And it was about a world in which we solve scarcity through changing what we want. So, you know, one of the main questions about whether we have enough or need more is what we want, right? And so, you know, someone who, for example, expects that they'll have 10 children and each will have their own bedroom needs a lot more house, you know, than someone who wants to be childless or live on their own. And so what we want is very elastic. And Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom is about these changes in how people view what's enough and what's too much and what's a sufficiency and what's an abundance. And then I wrote this novel in 2009 called Makers that was about advanced manufacturing techniques, that kind of make movement where 3D printers and related technologies allow people everywhere to make stuff incredible low cost and without the kind of synchrony that industrialization demands, where in order to have lots of material goods, we sacrifice our ability to do what we want when we want to do it, so that, you know, we all have to stand in the assembly line and do the same task over and over and over again. Makers is about what happens when you can get that kind of industrial scale production, but with an individual's autonomy, you know, where it all takes place at the edge. And that also is a big piece of the abundance problem, right? If we can make things more efficiently, we can get more stuff with the same core resource. You know, there's a beautiful study that was done by these two Bank of Canada economists who are IKEA freaks, back to the internet, supercharging our hobbies. So these two people, they had saved all their IKEA catalogs for decades. And, you know, their spouses were like, "What are you going to do with those things?" And they had an idea for what to do with them. What they decided to do was use them as a data set to see what the correlates were of a piece of furniture appearing year to year in the IKEA catalog instead of being discontinued.
Huh.
And what they found is that long-lived IKEA products are products that every year get lighter. They become more efficiently packed, so they occupy less cubic inches when they're in shipment and have fewer countries of origin, so they're more logistically simple. In other words, the Billy bookcase that you have in your kid's bedroom that you bought 15 years ago and the Billy bookcase on the show floor today at an IKEA, although they look identical, they're completely different animals. They have orders of magnitude less embodied labor, energy, and material than the ones that were being made not so long ago. And that's true of cars and buildings and everything else we make. And so, you know, one of the answers maybe to the question of like, well, it would take six Earths for us all to live like an American. How are we all going to do that? Mm-hmm. Maybe the answer is we reduce the material inputs to living like an American by 5/6. But even so, as William Gibson said, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. And that's where walkaway comes in. Because efficiency is the third corner of this abundance triangle. There's what we want, what we can make, and then how we get a hold of the things that we want at the moment that we want them when they're being made. You know, right now we have these efficiency problems where, you know, we only need a lawnmower for 6 months a year every 2 weeks. And so we all have like the 11th best lawnmower sitting in our garages. And that's a cost, not an asset, because it's, you know, it's crappy. No one enjoys using it. And it's not very efficient use of your garage space. In an ideal world, you'd have something like Zipcar for our lawnmowers. And the moment that you needed a lawnmower, one would trundle up at exactly that moment, and it would be the greatest lawnmower you could imagine. And the data generated by your lawn mowing experience would be used to improve it. So the next time you got it, it would be even better. And it would trundle off to the next person needed it at the moment that they need it too. And that's the thing that the internet has also supercharged, our ability to coordinate ourselves. So now we can like build encyclopedias with the kind of organizational overheads that we used to use for like an ambitious bake sale. So being able to coordinate our material is the last corner of this triangle. And by writing about these three things as though they were the only thing in the world, which is the science fiction writer's trick, to take one technology and build a world around it, not to predict it, but to show what its latent characteristics are, I think I'm starting to dig out something about where our abundance in the future might be.
Cory Doctorow, author of the new novel Walk Away, is my guest here on KD&K Community Radio. Walk Away is sexy and visceral, but it's also brutal at times. I want to ask you what it's like to create these fascinating characters that the reader falls in love with, but then run them through the ringer. I mean, is there a temptation to leave out the violent overreach of the powers that be and just stick to the bliss and philosophy?
You know, I wish I was a good enough person to say, yeah, that's totally true. I don't like to brutalize my characters. But the reality is that some part of me is the plotter's brain, and it's sitting there in the background, and it's just counting down the seconds since the last time someone came into the room holding a gun.
Uh-huh.
And I have this, like, kind of nervous itch to make the story more story-like. And, you know, it's easy when I talk about these kind of high-flown ideas that are in Walk Away to give the impression that Walk Away is this kind of dry academic tome, or even, you know, a kind of Malcolm Gladwell-y stories about the real world kind of story. But it's a pulp novel.
Right.
It's, you know, the foundation of a pulp novel is a person in a place with a problem who tries intelligently to solve it and fails through no fault of their own. So they have a new problem to solve that's even worse than the one that they were solving before. And the problems get worse and worse and worse until they can't get any more worse. The stakes are as high as they can go. And that's the climax. And, you know, if you plot using that rule of thumb, the problems have to get worse. The people have to intelligently try to solve them. They have to have a plausible chance of solving them, but fail through no fault of their own, so that the problems get worse still, then eventually something really terrible does have to happen to your people, because that's what happens when the problems get worse and worse and worse. But that's what keeps you turning the page, right? That's you know, William Gibson, to bring him up for a third time, maybe we should take a drink every time I mention him. Bill did this great interview with the Paris Review where they said, you know, what's it like when you know, literary professors look down their nose at you for being a pulp writer? And he says, well, when that happens, I think to myself, whatever else my merits or demerits are, at least I can plot. By God, my tractor has wheels on it. I am a descendant of Dashiell Hammett. And, you know, you can't write that kind of fiction. You can't make those omelets without breaking eggs.
The language in the book Walk Away sometimes feels so evolved, so fresh, you know, like too next level for the paper it's printed on. The character Limpopo says she knew that stuff was a liability, not an asset. And there's this idea of getting rid of your things when you're a walk away. When you think about your readers, does it interest you to know who's reading your book on a device versus who's reading on good old dead trees?
Well, I'm more interested in like the funny use cases for reading it in one way or another, not just the raw numbers. You know,
right.
I was fascinated not long ago when I was sitting on a plane next to a couple of older people, retired people who were on their way on a vacation, and they had taken a book and pulled the binding off, and they were reading the pages and passing them back and forth. One, the faster reader would hand them to the slower reader, you know, she would hand them to him, and then he would crumple them up and put them in the seat back so that they're like, load was getting lighter as they went, right? I love stories about people who are print impaired, who find in ebooks the ability to do text to speech, mm-hmm. or who are able to size the print up. You know, as someone who's 46 and whose eyes were never great, this is a really interesting thing. I'm told by my optometrist that varifocal glasses are starting to go out of fashion because so many people, when their vision starts going, switch to a tablet and just size up the type. That's super interesting. I swim every day because I have a bad back, and I have an underwater MP3 player, and I listen to audiobooks, and I get through two novels a month in the pool, right? So those use cases I find super interesting, because reading is this very old activity, but it's not always been the same activity. You know, silent reading only starts with the monks who had the vow of silence. Right. Before that, reading was, people didn't know how to read quietly. We don't have any evidence of people reading in their head. There was only one way to read, and that was to say the words while you read them. So the evolution of how we experience text, as someone who is both an avid reader and earns his living from, you know, inventing fairy tales to help you pass the long slog from the cradle to the grave, that I find super fascinating.
Speaking of fairy tales, one of your characters thinks of the ancient movies about space travel she'd binged on, and you write, she realized all those dramatic situations about getting into space were wish fulfillment and or parochial fear-mongering. I'd love to know about your earliest sci-fi influences and what else you're reading lately. You mentioned Rebecca Solnit was part of the seed for this book.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in a great science fiction town. You know, Denver, you've got the tattered cover, but in Toronto, we had Baca Books, still around. It's the oldest science fiction bookstore in the world, and it has always had writers working in it while they became, you know, well off enough to quit their day jobs and write full time. So when I was 9 years old, I took a school trip to Baca, and Tanya Huff, who writes as T.S. Huff sometimes, was working behind the counter, and she brought me to the back section of the store where the used books were, and she found me a $1 used copy of H. Beam Piper's Little Fuzzy and said, I think you'll enjoy this. And then I would come down and spend all my pocket money, and Tanya would find me great books. And when she quit her job to write full time in the country, I got her job. And not only that, but Toronto was home to the Merrill Collection, which back then it was called the Spaced Out Library. Judith Merrill was this radical science fiction editor and writer and critic who, in 1968, as an objector to the Vietnam War, moved to Canada and brought her book collection, which she'd amassed with her ex-husband, Frederick Pohl, and donated it to the Toronto Public Library, where it formed the nucleus of what's now the largest public reference collection of science fiction in the world. And she was the writer in residence, and you could go and show her your manuscripts, and she would critique them and introduce you to other writers that you should get in a writer's group with, which is how I ended up in a writer's group with people like Carl Schrader and Peter Watts and others. And Judy was also the public television host of our weekly Doctor Who episode. Huh. And once a week, I would sit down with my dad, and Judy would come on and introduce the week's Doctor Who episode and say, these are the science fiction traditions that these writers are drawing on. These are the books and stories that these writers were inspired by when they made up this Doctor Who episode. So I was really steeped in it when I was a kid. As to what I'm reading now, gosh, I'm in the middle of a really fun book by a writer named Rob Reed called After On. He wrote a comic novel before about aliens who came to Earth because they had accidentally pirated all this music by listening to it as it escaped from our atmosphere. And they were super obsessed with lawfulness. And so having encountered the farcical penalties that that the Recording Industry Association of America had managed to get the U.S. Congress to pass, they came to, like, give us quintillions of dollars for having pirated our music. After On is a much more contemporary kind of micro-surfish novel that's really good fun and very much in the same tradition of another novel that's just about to come out by Robin Sloan called Sourdough. And he's another one of these Silicon Valley kind of micro-surfish kind of writer. He is an ex-Twitter employee, and he wrote this great, great novel called Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookshop. And this is his second book, Sourdough. And it's about someone who works in a robotics factory, a robotics startup, who becomes obsessed with baking sourdough bread and with the microbiome of sourdough bread. And it fuses the story of, like, worker alienation and embodied consciousness and microbiomes and microbiology with robotics in this beautiful way. And it's such a like a light comic novel, a kind of Robert Persig or Armistead Maupin kind of novel, but it's about robotic arms and sourdough bread. It's really good fun.
Thanks so much for the tips. Cory Doctorow is a best-selling author, co-editor of the website Boing Boing, activist in residence at MIT's Media Lab, and former European director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. His latest novel is Walk Away. I want to ask you about boingboing.net. When did it start? Who are the leaders of the project? And what's it like to be part of something that started small but now reaches millions?
Sure. Well, you know, back in the 80s, long before I was ever involved with Boing Boing, a couple of Coloradans, Mark Frauenfelder and Carlos Sinclair, they started a print zine called Boing Boing, which, you know, it was the golden age of zines. It was when there were a couple of national distributors for them, and the nascent internet was letting people share news of which zines might be interesting. So you could, you know, write a check for a dollar and put it in an envelope and mail it to the zine publisher and have it arrive in your mailbox. And I used to sell Boing Boing when I worked at Baca Books. We used to sell it in our newsstand.
Nice.
And Mark and Carla moved to San Francisco when the dot-com bubble started, and they were seeking money to make Boing Boing bigger, and they were also working at Wired. And Boing Boing, its distributor collapsed and took down Boing Boing and all the other small zines of the day. It was like this kind of extinction level event for small press publishing in the early 90s, mid 90s. And Mark started writing for the Industry Standard. John Battelle at the Industry Standard assigned him to write a review of a new service called Blogger. So Mark decided he would see if he could make a little blog, which was this new idea, out of his old zine, Boing Boing. And so he registered boingboing.net and installed Blogger on it. And it started to do really well for him. It was really fun. He was getting, you know, dozens of daily readers. And so when he went on holiday, he asked me if I'd guest edit, because we knew each other. And I said, sure. And then he asked me if I'd stay on. And we brought in a couple more friends that we knew from Wired magazine. And over the years, it went from dozens of readers to thousands of readers to millions of readers. And it got to a point where we needed to actually start paying bills because we had so many readers. The bandwidth
right.
costs were starting to kill us.
Right.
We started to take ads. We became a multi-million dollar business, reaching about 9 million people a month. And that's where we sit today. And we're now a collective of about 6 people. And we have a couple of freelancers who write for us as well. And what we do is we write about the stuff that we find fascinating personally, as though we were explaining it to someone who had similar interest to us, but was but hadn't found out about this thing yet. And that's a very powerful thing. Unlike traditional publishing, where you would identify a group of people who advertisers wanted to reach, then figure out what subjects they wanted to read about, and then find someone to try and entice them to read the articles so the advertisers could see them. Mm. With us, it was always about writing the stuff that we were interested in and trusting that the internet would find us the people who thought that that stuff was interesting too. And it worked out really well. You know, I don't think that there's huge cohorts of Boing Boing readers in most of the world. I think we're a very thinly distributed group, even though we're millions strong. That's millions strong against billions of people, even if you just want to limit it to English speakers. But because the internet allows us to sort of semi-perfectly reach all of those people, we're able to build one of these niche businesses that's really about pursuing our own passions. And then for me, writing about the things that I find interesting in a way that tries to convey the interest to a notional stranger, mm-hmm. that helps me start to find these connections between ideas. It's much more rigorous than the notes you might take for yourself in your own little pocket notebook, because you have to show a stranger why you're taking the note too. And that creates this kind of like super saturated solution of fragmentary story ideas kind of lurking in the back of my mind. And every now and again, a couple will like glom together and nucleate and then crystallize into stories or novels or essays or, you know, bigger, more synthetic pieces.
For folks who aren't familiar with the concept, talk about net neutrality, why it's such a big deal. We've seen an outcry from millions of Americans standing up for this idea of an open internet. But do you think there is any chance the FCC or Congress will listen?
Yeah, I hope so. So for starters, net neutrality is a very simple idea that the reason you have internet service is because when you click on something, that's the thing you want to see, and the person you're paying for internet service should get you that as quickly as they can. And network discrimination, the thing that the cable operators and the phone companies want, is the ability to go to the people you're trying to reach, who are paying their own internet service providers, who have lots of bandwidth to reach you with. And to say to them, hey, I've got these customers and I'm the only way you can reach them. They want to see your service. If you want me to deliver your packets to them, I want to charge you again. I want to hold these people to ransom. And, you know, it's you can think of it like, imagine that you picked up the phone and called, you know, Joe's Pizzeria on the corner. And Joe's Pizzeria has like three phone lines and only one of them is busy. And they, you know, Joe Jr. is there ready to answer the phone when it rings and take your pizza order. But when you call, instead of Joe Jr. getting your ring and answering the phone and taking your pizza order, you get a message that says, although there is capacity to reach Joe's Pizzeria, they have not paid for premium service. Press 1 now to speak to Domino's or wait 30 seconds. Right? That's what the phone company is saying. Even though Joe's has capacity to reach you, even though you want to reach Joe's, Domino's has paid for preferential carriage. And so even when there's enough room to connect the two of you, the phone company doesn't want to do it. They want to hold you for a few seconds in the hopes that Domino's will continue to spend for extra carriage. And, you know, the phone company's position is, well, you don't have to like this idea, but it's our phone network. If you don't like it, build your own phone network and you can run it however you want. But the reality is that the phone companies are not free market enterprises. The phone companies are effectively regulation kind of wrapped in copper wire. Because if you want to start a phone company, you don't get to just dig up all the sidewalks in Denver or New York or all the sidewalks between Denver and New York to reach your cable across them. You go to the government, and the government gives you this massively discounted right-of-way, sometimes an even free right-of-way, to dig up every foot of sidewalk, to go into everyone's basement, to stick up poles, to do all of those things. Now, if you had to go and negotiate with every person who owned property between New York and Denver, or every street in Denver and every sidewalk, it would cost you trillions. So the phone companies get this multi-trillion dollar subsidy to operate a network. And then the public very reasonably says, if we're going to give you trillions of dollars worth of value, we want you to build the network that we want to use, not the one that's best for your shareholders. And the phone companies are like, well, you know, we don't like regulation, but really what they're saying is we only like the regulation that gives us stuff for free, not the regulation that expects us to give something back for that regulatory gift. When network neutrality started, it started actually by a friend of mine from Toronto. This idea came from this kid, Tim Wu, or this guy, Tim Wu, who when we were kids, you know, we went to the same little elementary school. And when Tim started talking about net neutrality, nobody had any idea what he was talking about. It was so weird and wonky. But when this became an issue a year ago under the last years of the Obama administration, and the FCC started thinking about it, millions of people wrote to their lawmakers and to the FCC to endorse the idea of a free and open internet. And now we've got tens of millions of people writing in. So the FCC right now, it's run by Trump appointees. The guy who's running it, he's an ex-telecoms lobbyist. He's basically said he's going to kill net neutrality no matter what. He doesn't care what we have to say because he's already made up his mind. But, you know, he is ultimately answerable to Congress, and it's very hard for Congress to get reelected if they don't get money from phone companies, but it's even harder for them to get reelected if they don't get votes. And when tens of millions of people call Congress, call the FCC, send in emails and say, look, Bozo, I'm going to vote for the anyone but you party in the next election if you don't stand up for this thing that we need. They start to get the message. And so maybe we lose this time, but it won't be a final loss. It'll just be two steps forward when we got net neutrality under Obama, one step back when we lose it under Trump. Maybe next time we'll get three steps forward because so many people will care about it. Now, I prefer that we not lose net neutrality to begin with, but we can salvage some victory from that defeat in the form of mobilizing people around this formerly obscure issue that's becoming more and more salient to more and more people's lives.
Last question. You recently hosted a talk at New York Public Library with NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden beaming in from Russia where he has asylum. How's Ed doing?
My impression is that he is bearing up extraordinarily well. Like so many of us who care about the internet, he's a bit neuroatypical in that his like his body is sometimes just an inconvenient meat suit for all the places that he wants to send his mind. And that although, you know, in an ideal world, his body would be free to roam the world, the fact that his mind is free to roam the world, that he can beam himself anywhere over the internet and continue to intervene in these policy matters that he really gave up his freedom to defend, I think that he's bearing up with extraordinary grace because of that. He's doing very well.
Best-selling author Cory Doctorow's latest novel is Walk Away. It's a fascinating read. It's been so fun talking to you. Folks can check out more of your work at boingboing.net.
Oh, thank you. Can I mention one last thing? The audiobook of Walk Away is amazing. Will Wheaton and Amber Benson from Buffy and Amanda Palmer and others all read the audiobook, but you may have a hard time finding it because it's not available on Audible, because I won't let them lock it up with their DRM copy protection. But you can get it anywhere else. You can get it at Downpour or Libra.fm or whatever. And I hope you'll check it out because it is great.
Cory Doctorow, thanks so much.
Thanks.